So good morning, Dr. Fleming, and this is the third in our series of what I've found to be very informative. A lot of stuff's brand new to me, so I hope it's brand new to the listeners as well. We're a man down today because Dusty wasn't able to join us. So I think we may tread into some questions that I've had but hadn't had a chance to ask. We've talked about so many different things. So real quick, just a bio for people who may not have listened in order or listened in sequence. Not that there's really a sequence, but they would have met you in the other two shows. So a real quick kind of bio, and then we'll jump right in.
Well, good morning. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be back here again, and I'm sure I'm looking forward to your questions. I have an idea what some of them are, but you're always surprising me with some. I'm a physicist physician, originally from the state of Iowa. Grew up during the 60s at a time where the Kennedy JFK administration provided some unique opportunities for people like myself to get some advanced degrees. Went to the University of Iowa for medical school and several of the universities afterwards during my internship, residency, then fellowship. I'm certified, boarded in internal medicine and nuclear cardiology, as well as PET certified. And I've spent a lot of time, almost four decades, working on the errors that we make in imaging and putting together the theory of inflammation and heart disease and angina, and incorporating all of that into a bigger package of trying to allow us to do a better job of figuring out what's wrong with people and why, and what we can objectively determine for each individual, and then allow us to treat people on a per person basis versus a, gosh, we think this ought to work for you, versus let's actually measure the outcome of your treatment, saving time, money, and lives.
So honestly, I have so many questions. I'm not really sure where to start. I'm not sure what order they go in. But one of the first things I would really like for you to expand upon is your theory or philosophy or, you know, way of thinking about this spectrum of health, as opposed to disease, as opposed to somebody being sick. What are your thoughts, or what is your theory on this health spectrum that all people are on?
Right. Well, great question. And I've dubbed it the health spectrum, which was actually a term I came up with in the last 1 to 2 years. The ability to actually measure what's going on in people's bodies, as opposed to just getting a yes-no approach where we think you have a problem, or no, we don't, we think you have a problem, which results in people having problems missed or being told they have a problem and doing a whole bunch of tests and treatments when they really didn't need it. The ability to measure it means that we can really define from one end of the spectrum where you lie at. And the reality here is that it also helps us to recognize that people just don't suddenly have heart disease or cancer. Like we mentioned before the program, you know, Bernie Sanders didn't just suddenly wake up with heart disease. This is a process that was building over years. And the ability to have tests that actually measure that allow us to find a problem sooner. And the importance of finding a problem sooner doesn't mean that we want to be treating people with medications or stents for heart disease, for example, or chemotherapy or radiation therapy. When it comes to cancer, it means finding problems sooner when we know that there's these changes going on in the body that if we were to address sooner, we could do it in lifestyle and dietary ways or vitamin ways, or more what some people would call holistic, although I'm not sure what that means. The approach to allow us to actually catch a problem when it's transitioning and move it back so that we're spending less time and less money, and actually, you know, falling back to the origins of medicine, which was, you know, diet is the fundamental treatment, and taking care of people's health. And I think we've gotten, you know, medicine has done a great job of dealing with emergencies. And for many years, that's where our focus was, because if you have somebody dying on the street from a heart attack, or they're dying from cancer, the emergency is to keep them from dying. Now that we've gotten some of a handle on that, we need to be asking more fundamental questions, which is, what can we do earlier on that is less toxic to make a difference? And what can we do in addition to what we've been using for treatments that is less toxic that may make a difference? You know, one of the hot topics right now is which people should be on medicines to lower cholesterol levels for what's called primary prevention. These are the people that have higher cholesterols than we would like to see, but they haven't had a heart attack or a stroke or some other complication yet. And the truth of the matter is, we don't know. We don't know because we've never measured studies. And part of what we now know, the original work on this was published way back in 2008, is that if we look at the blood tests that we routinely do, you know, cholesterol and CRP and homocysteine and fibrinogen, and we measure the changes in those tests that occur over time with the changes that occur in heart disease when we measure it, they don't correlate at all. There's no relationship. Yes, having a higher cholesterol is not a good thing, but what's happening in the blood and what's happening in the tissue within the arteries of the heart themselves, those are two completely different phenomena, and they are determined by you as an individual and exactly the environment going on in your body. So the ability to measure that allows us to find problems sooner. So instead of focusing on the end result, disease treatment, we really need to think about how we can help people live longer, healthier lives on a health spectrum. So these measurements place you on your health spectrum, and then they allow us to treat you individually and then remeasure the effect that whatever we did, diet, drug, radiation therapy, actually had on you as an individual, so that we can know and we can guide your treatment. You know, a lot of people talk about why aren't we living to over 100 to 120, which, by the way, is how long I plan to live. So I'm middle age right now. But doing it healthy is the key, because if we wait until the end of the game to address these problems, we're waiting until damage has been done to people, which is just not the way to do it. So a health spectrum is, you know, I'm in, as I've said before, I'm in healthcare. I'm not in disease care.
Right.
You know, and that's the problem that we have, you know, and it doesn't matter whether you're talking about Medicare for all or Medicaid for all or health insurance of whatever. The focus for many of these people is the end game, what causes the problem. And we need to get out of a last minute ditch disease care. What can we do to keep you alive and throw all of our resources at it to a what type of healthcare model can we provide to do things that you come to the doctor and you go, wait a minute, I'm not dealing with death. I'm dealing with mid-course corrections, so to speak, and I'm doing things that make a difference. And I know it makes a difference because I have a measured outcome that tells me where I lie in this health spectrum.
So there are two points that I want to address in all of that you just said. And so these questions may seem like they're separated from each other. So I'll let you decide which one goes first and how you want to answer them both.
That's okay. So, I'll take this like a classroom.
Like I'm throwing questions from everywhere. So kind of anecdotally, over my course of my career being a radiation therapist, we've always heard that in between the time that a cancer develops and a woman can feel a lump in her breast is about 10 years. You know, I don't know where that information came from. It just seems to be something that we repeat. So you've got this 10-year window, and that's kind of what you were saying, that it takes that Bernie Sanders didn't just get heart disease. A woman doesn't just get breast cancer. So what is the importance of being able to measure quantifiably over that decade? And then the second part of that, you kind of referred to this mid-course correction sort of thing. Right. And another, once again, stat that I'm not sure where it came from, but that 50% of all cancers are preventable, in that it's environmental, it's diet, lack of exercise, smoking, obesity, being in the sun, those kinds of things. So talking about how you can better take care of yourself, or how some of these things could be handled. You mentioned the word holistically. I'm not sure if it's holistic to stay out of the sun or tanning bed or whatever, but that you could prevent some of these things down the road. So what's the importance of being able to quantifiably measure these things? And then what's the importance of some of this environmental stuff that we subject ourselves to?
Okay, and I'll try to remember all those different points. You know, one of the criticisms that we get with doing testing, and again, much of what we have or everything else that we have is a qualitative test, a visual appearance or a blood test, which is a peripheral suggestion that there's a problem, is that our tests may be picking up problems sooner and sooner and sooner. However, people aren't really living any longer. So we're just finding a problem sooner the way we've been doing it, throwing more money at it. And in the end, people are still dying at the same amount of time. That's not what we're, you know, the ability to measure changes that, because what we're doing is finding things much sooner. And we're not telling people that you need expensive treatments. In fact, your question about, you know, what works and what doesn't work is all basically, it's all basically hearsay, in the sense that, you know, we don't have measurable data to show the outcomes of what the treatment of staying out of the sun is. If you go stay in the sun for a long period of time, do you have a greater risk of it causing skin damage? Absolutely. Okay. But you also need some sun exposure to develop vitamin D. Okay. That's a great example that, you know, African Americans develop skin cancer, but there are a lot of people who think that they don't because their skin is hyperpigmented by comparison, so therefore they won't have cancer, right? I mean, that's just naive, you know, and it shows a lack of consideration for everybody across the board. The problem is that much of what we have for data is much of what we have for data is big pharmaceutically paid for. You know, so the goal is to come up with an outcome. And so we do studies with the hope that we will actually see an outcome. Whether we actually have a measurable outcome or not is a completely different question. You know, there's something called intent to treat. And intent to treat, something I'm writing about in one of the three books that I'm putting together right now, is the tendency for researchers to take and start a study. And then if there's a problem with people that are in a treatment group, they get dropped out of the study and their numbers aren't included. Well, guess what? Their bad outcome is part of the study. Right. So, you know, dropping them out skews the data to make it look better. And then when people, you know, physicians take a treatment and they go, well, 70% of the people got better using this approach, so Mrs. Jones, we should use this approach. Well, it means 30% didn't. But if, you know, the example I used and what I was writing down yesterday is, let's say 70 out of 100 people got better with a blood pressure medication. And you say, gee, that works in 70% of the people. But the study really started with 115 people, where 15 people were dropped out because they couldn't tolerate the medicine. Well, intent to treat, you get to ignore those 15, where in reality, no, you have to include those 15 because they didn't do well. And if you get started on that medicine and you don't do well, it turned out that 60% of the people got better. Big difference when you're looking at these numbers. So much of what we have has been biased with intent to treat models and the visual. We think he got better, you didn't get better. You know, nobody goes back and changes the result of a chemotherapy trial drug when they say, well, X percent of people got better with this because of their five-year survival curves. As we've talked about before, five-year survival doesn't mean you're cancer-free. It means you're not dead. And nobody goes back and includes in the data and says, oops, well, the result wasn't quite as good because she died at 6 years. Well, her five, you know, the problem is we have really lousy data on most of everything that we're doing for, including the primary prevention stuff, you know, from coronary artery disease. And so the ability to measure is going to refine this down to a per person approach so that we actually know what happens to you. And that's critical because when we're talking about, and I hate to use the expression this way, but throwing money at a problem, which is sometimes what we're doing, which is throwing money at it, right, isn't helping the person. And then the person gets frustrated because they came into their doctor for treatment and doctor so-and-so said this was the best thing to do and they threw all this treatment, you know, and then everybody gets frustrated because there's a bad outcome. And I'm tired of dealing with bad outcomes because we haven't been able to measure it. You know, I think most everybody will say they will suffer, I've said this before, suffer whatever you ask them to suffer through if it makes a difference. But you know what? If I put you, if you have metastatic breast cancer and I put you on whatever drug it is, and then we repeat FMT-VDM and we discover that that drug had absolutely no impact, why am I putting you on five more months of that treatment with all the toxic benefits? Either we should be switching to something else, or we should say, Mrs. Jones, and I hate to use that as an example, but you know, Mrs. Jones or Mrs. Smith or Mrs. Whoever or Mr. Whoever, it's up to you. If you want to continue this for five more months, you should have a say in this, but here's what we see. It's not changing anything. You know, this is Albert Einstein said, like a lot of people, insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result. Medicine is, believe it or not, a science. And I kind of get the feeling that most people treat people based upon a feeling. And, you know, that's really nice and warm and fuzzy, but people die because of that.
So I think I've mentioned in previous recordings that I have a strong family history of breast cancer. Mm-hmm. Two of my mother's sisters passed away from breast cancer. And I think this could probably stand true if we're talking about heart disease or, you know, anything else. Do you mind to take us through what that measurement period would look like? And we'll just use breast cancer as an example. Right. Where do you get the baseline? When do you get the baseline? And I'm talking about before you're diagnosed or, you know, if you do have a high risk or whatever. What is that period of watching someone over, you know, a course of several years or a decade or forever, hopefully, and it never develops? What does that look like in a practical, you know, sense for maybe for somebody who wonders how that actually works?
Right. And let me back up and hit something that you asked in the last question. We don't know if it takes 10 years for a cancer to develop. Okay.
I have no idea where that came from. It's just something I've always.
We have no quantitative data. And if you just go look at books or you do a Google search, my favorite medical degree. I got my Google degree. You will read whatever somebody has put out there. And today, you know, with the internet, garbage is put out there by everybody and their uncle. So you have a greater chance of finding misinformation than if you had to go look in the library like my generation did, where you went and you found, like, there were genetics textbooks that didn't have 23 sets of chromosomes in human beings. They had other numbers of sets of chromosomes because that's what they thought people had. You go look in those books and you'll go, wow. A friend of mine, Dr. William Dooley, who's probably one of the best cancer surgeons in the United States at Oklahoma, once pointed out to me that, you know, the number of milk ducts that women have in their breasts are reported from a single pathology specimen that was done some time ago. And it was an unusual woman because the numbers that were reported are way high compared to what most women have. So the misinformation that's floating around about that is huge as well. BRCA1 and BRCA2, breast cancer gene 1, breast cancer gene 2, or Lynch syndrome or any of a number of genetic syndromes, means that you have a genetic predisposition to potentially having a problem under the right circumstances. With BRCA1 and 2, there's an increased risk of having breast cancer, ovarian cancer, uterine cancer, or if you're a man, prostate cancer. It's a hormonally mediated gene. That's what I call it, because these are all hormonally mediated cancers. It doesn't mean you're going to have one. And so telling somebody that they have a predisposition for something doesn't mean they're going to have it. We develop cancer and we develop heart disease, not because we have a gene. We develop it because our genetic predisposition put in contact with the environment of our cells, which are all the things that you do and all the medications you take and all the toxins you breathe in and everything put together that gets to the cell. Those two things interact. And exactly how they interact in you is not the same way they interact in me or anybody watching this program. Everybody is unique. So just because you are predisposed to something does not mean you are going to have it. Okay, number one. Number two, we don't know what the numbers are because everything has been a qualitative visual guess up to now. So quantification, what FMTVDM provides us, is opening the future. It is a brand new door that we are stepping through to a completely new way of practicing medicine. And every piece of information we collect is going to be something that becomes part of textbooks as they're being written from here on out, just like the textbook that's coming out on FMTVDM. Now, how frequently do we need to do that? The answer is we don't know, but we will find out. And the key to this is, first off, when we make these measurements, there's two things that we look at. One is the actual measurement, the maximum measurement, which tells us how far to the unhealthy end of the health spectrum you lie. And we look at the variability of what's going on. How much variability is there, let's say, in breast tissue? Mm-hmm. The more variability there is going on, the more that change is happening. The tighter that variability is, the consistency means this is where the tissue is. It's not going anywhere. It is settling in. So by comparing two numbers, we can tell you which direction you're moving on your health spectrum and how rapidly it's changing. More variability, it's changing more rapidly. Less variability, it's settled in. Not very sophisticated when you think about it. You know, I'd love to say that there's something much more intellectually thought-provoking, but it's just the reality of things. And as I've shared with you, the work that we're publishing now has shown us that the changes in these tissue actually, as they transition, they change. The body is actually working through these things. So if you have BRCA1 and 2, like Angelina Jolie, this is not the time for you to go out and have a bilateral prophylactic mastectomy or have your breasts removed, because I understand it. The reason for doing that is you've got a gene that somebody says you're predisposed to cancer and you want it gone, right? Except it didn't remove the risk of breast cancer. It just removed the amount of breast tissue she had to get breast cancer, because as long as you still have skin, you still have breast tissue because it's embedded in it. And that breast tissue still has a BRCA1 and gene, 1 and 2 gene in it. So you haven't changed what could happen. You've only changed how much breast tissue you have to happen. And now you add on to it an implant, which makes these qualitative tests like mammography and MRI and CT useless, but not FMTVDM, because again, it's measuring regional blood flow changes in metabolism. And guess what? In a breast implant, there is no regional blood flow or metabolism, so it's not fooled. And in dense breasts, which are normal breast tissue, just more connective tissue holding it together and glandular tissue functioning, that's completely normal. So its blood flow and its metabolism is normal. So it doesn't care that the breast tissue is dense. It doesn't care if you have a breast implant. It says, foolish human, your eye may be tricked, but I'm measuring what's happening, and this is where you sit. So if we'd have had FMTVDM up and running prior to now, and I guess I should say, I'm sorry, it took 20 years to develop, but look, guys and gals, it wasn't an overnight figure it out type thing. It's evolving as we speak. In fact, the machine learning going on right now between the different pieces of quantitative apparatus that I'm using to exchange is refining even today what we're learning from this technique and our ability to, as I said, with cancers, now detect that even within the transitional changes like inflammation and precancers and cancers, there are subgroups falling out given the data showing transitional subtle changes that are occurring in the growth rate patterns, which I find just fascinating because for me, one of the fascinating things in science and my research is that when I do something and I discover it, and then I'm perplexed, and then I discover that, wait a minute, somebody proposed a theory on this 60 to 100 years ago that I didn't even know it existed. And then you go look at that and you go, well, hey guys, now A, congratulations, you were right, and B, guess what? You're right, but I proved it, not you. So, okay. But just sorry, shouldn't do that.
No, you absolutely should do that.
But you know, it's reaffirming to me because it says, wait a minute, I'm not the first person who thought about it, and it fits what's going on. And what that means is that we're not all out to lunch. We really are on target, but we haven't had the way to measure it yet. So there's so much potential here. So the answer to that is, what's that maximum value and how much variability is there? Because I can give you a different impression on how long we should wait. If all the numbers have settled in together, that's where you're at. But if there's a wide variability going on, well, that means there's change happening, and that means we probably should be thinking about doing it sooner than later. And I'm not going to give you a number, and I wouldn't give you a number even if I had a number, because right. The problem with insurance companies and CMS and Medicaid for all is that they want a number so they can put a hard and fast rule. And when we're treating people in a health spectrum, we're treating you, not a hard and fast rule.
Right. That's a whole nother show.
Yeah.
To talk about numbers and CMS and that's a whole different show, and which we might get to. Not coming from the molecular imaging world, you know, I'm a radiation therapist. If Dusty were here, she could explain it all to me. Can you just do a generic, let's use that term so that we don't get into your, you know, very specific techniques. A generic, if I was a woman going in for this type of measurement, this type of imaging, what does that look like for me as a patient?
The process, you know, the process is actually using everything. The steps that we've been doing for other tests are the same steps as far as what you experience as a patient. So, you know, FMT-VDM has a special breast component, which is called breast enhanced scintigraphy test, or okay. BEST. The best okay. test for the breast is BEST. Okay, that's the end of my.
That's pretty catchy.
I came up with that years ago. I thought that was great, but I'm not a marketing person. So it's breast. It's enhanced, and I'll tell you briefly, scintigraphy, because that's what our nuclear cameras measure. Scintillations, okay. The breakdown of radioactive decay, and scintillation means sparkle, and then it's a test, BEST, okay? So you come in, and we have you coming in fasting, not eating, because we want to measure changes in blood flow. And if you eat, you have to increase the blood flow to your stomach to digest. And no okay. offense, but I don't care how well you're digesting food. Okay, it's not what you're there for, number one. It could be used for you know, those types of tests as this evolves over, but I don't care how well you're digesting food. I want to know whether you have breast cancer in this case, okay? So I want your blood flow to be left alone so I can change it, okay? And so you'll have you'll come in. They'll have you take off your clothes and put on one of those beautiful gowns that we're so well known for. You can either get paper ones or you can get the cloth ones. They're both just as embarrassing. Although the cloth ones are a little bit nicer, you'll have an IV put in because that's how we give you everything is through the vein, right? FYI, folks, don't have your nuclear techs put the IVs in. Are they able to do it? Yes, they are. Don't waste their time. They're doing more important things. There's tons of other people that can put IVs in, have the IVs put in by somebody else, so our nuclear techs can do their job that they're trained for, and you're not. Okay, that's my soap opera box pitch for that. You'll come in, and we will give you a medicine that is designed to relax your blood vessels. There's a whole host of them. It's now in the textbook. Those are designed to relax your blood vessels. Why? Because we want to enhance the delivery of the isotope. And we want to take advantage of the fact that there are differences in blood flow between calcium or breast implants, which is none, normal tissue, which has the amount it should have, inflammatory tissue where there's more blood flow to take and deal with the fact that something's wrong and your body's trying to get in there to address it, to precancerous and cancerous states that have lots more blood flow because they've released chemicals to make new blood supply so they can get more nutrients and grow faster, okay? Mm-hmm. So we want to enhance those differences to shift the isotope from the areas of normal to the abnormal areas. And then depending upon which one we give you, because they work in different time sequences, we can then give you what's called an isotope. It's something that decays. It's radioactive. Yes, it is. Everything on the planet is radioactive. To some extent or another, even the drinking water you're drinking is radioactive, okay? Hate to tell you that, that's called tritium, and that's what the hydrogen bomb was built from. We just took all the tritium out of the water, put it together, and well, and with
another show.
Off, another story. So we give this to you, and then we basically enhance where it goes. Because of the isotopes that we give you, they are taken up by the cells of the body, and the more metabolically active they are, the more they're taken up, and then we can measure those differences. Now that effect shifts the blood flow all over your body, and your body will tell you that. So if you have heart disease, even though you're not exerting yourself anymore, you may feel chest discomfort. You may feel nausea because when you increase blood flow to your stomach, that is one of the problems. You may get a headache because the only way your brain, this brilliant, intelligent organ, can tell you something has changed is to give you a headache. If your blood flow increases, it gives you a headache. If it decreases, it gives you a headache. If you get meningitis, it gives you a headache. If you get hit by a Mack truck, it gives you a headache. Okay? So that's the only way it has to tell you anything's different. It may, your body may not do that, but if it tells you that, the only thing you need to know is A, the effect of these enhancing agents is short-lived, some seconds after we shut them off, some 30 minutes. The second thing you need to know is that if you have a problem, we can reverse it when the test is done by giving you the antidote. And the antidote is anything that is caffeinated. So don't drink coffee, tea, soft drinks, or anything like that beforehand, because if you do, the enhancing agent won't work. And why show up to have a test if it's not going to work? On the other hand, if you have a headache or you get chest discomfort, or you feel nauseated or any of those things, they can give you the antidote for it when the test is done by offering you a cup of coffee or a lovely tea or soft drink or whatever your choice of poison is, or just leave you alone if you understand the fact that it's just temporary and I'm not dying from it, okay? Then we will, then the images are done. If you're doing breast cancer, it's 5 minutes each breast and then 5 minutes the front, and there are additional views that can be taken if there's a question. All that said and done, the IV gets taken out, a Band-Aid gets put on it, you get to turn back in that lovely robe, put your real clothes back on, and say goodbye. Going through the front desk, of course, on the way out. And then follow up with your doctor in whatever timing everybody works out. Okay, it should not be that long. And here's something I will emphasize. Since the studies will be done that same day, since they are quantitative measurements, there is no interpretation. And you will not get a test result that says you have cancer. You don't. You will have a test result that says, on this spectrum, here is where you sit. That's much more important. You dealt with it with cholesterol. You go into your doctor, they did a blood test. What's your cholesterol? It's 132. Okay, you don't know what 132 means, but you do know it's better than 179 and not as good as 63. Okay, that's the point. It tells you where you're at to provide some type of treatment guideline for. Okay, now, do those numbers fall in different places? Yes, depending upon the isotope, the type of camera you use, they will have different numbers. And those numbers, we have huge amounts of data. We have more than 1,000 people using one of the different approaches on where they actually sit. And those numbers will continue to refine. but it's telling you where you sit on this spectrum that allows you and your doctor and your family to make an intelligent decision about what you would like to do. And then by comparing differences over time, you know whether what you've decided to do is working or not. Okay, you get up, you leave, you go home. That really should be at your doctor by the next day. And here's one of my little soapbox things. No news is not good news. No news is no news. If you're sitting there when Pearl Harbor is being attacked and you're in Washington, D.C. and you get no news, you don't sit there and go, good news. They couldn't possibly have dropped any bombs on us, right? Because we didn't hear any. Yeah. Bad news, because there wasn't any way to communicate. If your doctor's office is not communicating with you, you pick up the telephone, and this will behavior modify them to have a much better system for communicating with you. FYI, the proposal when we get this fully operational for people is that you should be able to get your tests through a special portal link put on online by the people. Here's your image, here's your numbers, here's where you fall. Schedule your appointment, come in and talk to your doctor. Okay. So that you really don't have to wait that long. I all the rest of that has to do with the security of the internet and that type of thing. But the truth of the matter is those numbers are being measured today, not tomorrow or next week. So there is no excuse for not having those numbers available. Mrs. Jones, your number was 173 in the right breast, 124 in the left breast. The doctor would like you to schedule an appointment to come on in.
Right.
Okay? Period. That's not too terribly complicated.
So you mentioned giving families, patients and their families, the ability to make the appropriate for them decision, the appropriate for the measurement decision. And I know there's been some controversy over mammogram, because if it picks up like DCIS, you know, a tiny little breast cancer, you treat it, do you not treat it? Have we overtreated breast cancer? Are we treating everything? Do you have any concern that because of this spectrum, or is this going to be education of the provider? What is there a sweet spot? You know, where, like you said, you've got 123 in one breast, 173 in the other. Obviously, there's a difference there. You need to look into that. How do you know? How do you not overtreat? How do you not panic when somebody gets some numbers back? Like I said, is that just education of the provider? How do you know what the next step is to take?
It's education of everybody. To begin with, we've lived in a society where you either have disease or you don't. Okay? Number one, that's so naive. And so I don't even know how you connect that up with real biology. that's just fantasy land, right? I'm pretty certain there's a cancer cell starting in my body today, just like there is in everybody else on the planet. I expect my immune system to handle it. All right. What is DCIS? Good question, because by understanding there's transitions, there is no magic cutoff for that's cancer, that's not. It's not normal, right? How do we know it's not normal? Because it has a special name, DCIS. Huh? If it wasn't unique, we wouldn't have a nice little medical term for it. Nobody would have been able to figure out there was a need for it. But does that require treatment? Good question. Key points, what's that number? How much variability is there? Has it settled in? You know what? What is the best treatment for DCIS? In the absence of having a test that can quantify and measure like FMTVDM does, how do we really know what the best treatment is? This is the point in time at which the federal government and everybody else ought to be saying, we need to investigate this. We have a test now that can quantify it. Let's do studies that are and by the way, you don't need hundreds of thousands of people, because the reason why you need such massive numbers and such long periods of time is if you have to wait to see if somebody died in 5 years, you've automatically said that the study has to be 5 years. What's one of the problems with our cancer studies? We have to wait such a long time to see an outcome difference, because you have to wait to see And what they don't tell you is whether people died or not. You know, they say to see if there's a treatment outcome. What they mean is we have to wait and see how many people died because we don't have a way to really measure it. Now that you can measure it, you can figure out in much shorter periods of time whether treatment has an effect. And because you can measure it, you don't need massive numbers. The reason why you need large numbers of people in a study is because the difference in what you're doing is minuscule. And the only way you can statistically come up with something to say that a drug or a treatment is beneficial is take that minuscule difference and multiply it by thousands and hundreds of thousands of people. And now you have something that says, okay, they're different. God, you know, I'm sorry. If that is the basis of your treatment, throw that sucker out. You should be able to see a difference. If you can't see a difference in a treatment outcome without getting 100,000 people or 200,000 people involved, you don't have a treatment outcome that's worth using. Okay?
Right.
And we're throwing tons of money at very expensive treatment outcomes. You know, one of the first things that tells me that a physician who treats cancer understands what I'm talking about with this measurement is that the first response I get from them is, so wait a minute, you're telling me if I do this test and I give this treatment to the patient, I can, in a month, measure whether the treatment had an effect? That's the first thing that tells me they got it. Because when they do that paradigm shift, that they go, I can measure an outcome immediately and know, they understand the concept. So we don't need these massive amounts. And do you know how long it would take to do a DCIS study using FMT-VDM to take and determine what a treatment effect has?
A couple of weeks.
Month. Give them a month. I say give them a month. You know, and the reality is you start people, that would be a month, right? But yeah. So to get enough people in it, 6 months. Wow. In 6 months, we could have the outcome data of treatment for DCIS. And do we have an answer for that today? Let me think. No. Okay. By July 4th, we could have the treatment answers for DCIS. If the government got into it, geared it up and said, you know, we'd like to use your test. And like I told you on the last segment, if the federal government, if the United States of America says, we want to do a research project on this using FMT-VDM, I will say, for the purpose of finding answers for the people, you will sign a license agreement and an NDA so that you don't disclose all the details. I will provide this test free of charge for this purpose.
That's incredibly generous, and I hope somebody that could make that decision listens to us. And I mean, I know you've worked really hard on, 20 years, you said, on this. And to me, it just makes so much sense. Like you said, you can see that paradigm shift. And just over our conversations, because between you and I, this is our fourth conversation. And so over our conversations, I don't know why we're not moving further along with this or why it hasn't reached wide scale. I mean, I know you're still working with some, you know, trying to get your initial things out. But as far as, like you said, the government sort of stuff, it just makes common sense, or it just sounds like common sense to me.
Well, one of the issues is that when you come up with something that's a paradigm shift, what's the first thing people do if you take it to a university? They go, well, we didn't come up with it. You're right, you didn't. And you're not going to have your name on it saying that you came up with it, but you should want to be one of the first places to do it.
Right.
And egos get involved. And then, when you start explaining to people that you're going to cap the price on it, because this is something that people should be able to afford, that throws everybody into a loop. So they don't know what to do with that.
That's for our big pharma show.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. You know, when I was on 2020 back in 2004, and you know, the inflammation and heart disease theory I came up with in the mid 90s, but you know, and it came out in a medical textbook in 1999. You know, it wasn't until the 2004-2020 program that everybody and their uncle figured out, well, wait a minute, inflammation has to do with heart disease. But the producers of that program literally came to the city where I was at And one of their first comments was, I can't believe we came to this city to get this information. We're used to going to New York or Los Angeles or one of the major universities to get it. And I had to tell them that, you know, just explain something that had been explained to me so many times in life. Universities don't do research. Universities are buildings. They are buildings. They have students come there to learn and they have people doing research there, but universities don't do research.
Right.
People do. And that's why when grants are assigned to researchers, if that researcher leaves that university, guess where the grant goes?
With the
professor who's doing the research, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's don't take this wrong. It's what's here, not what's at a university, that determines what the research is.
And so yeah, I don't take that wrong at all.
I just don't want your viewers to. I mean, you know, and I take that with a certain sense of you know, something that a cardiologist taught me. So one of the cardiologists that trained me, he asked everybody if we knew the difference between his stethoscope and our stethoscopes. And there was a difference because he was using a different brand. And so I told him, and he says, no, the difference is that his stethoscope was connected to his brain. And I went, oh, okay, So I'm sensitive to just making those statements, but okay.
Well, I'm gonna ask one last question as we wrap up our time today, and I'm gonna go back to what you said about Angelina Jolie because that had such a social impact, and the fact that tissue that has the propensity to change was right. Still there. So I don't know if I've referred to this story before in one of our other talks, but I had a friend whose mother was diagnosed with ovarian cancer 20 years post hysterectomy. So, and nobody understood how could that happen. You know, her ovaries had been removed. How was she diagnosed with ovarian cancer? How would your quantifiable techniques, how would all of this measurement, how would that have played out in that situation that I just, you know, mentioned? And how could that have maybe not changed the outcome, but changed how they dealt with the outcome?
Right. Good question. Well, most of our data on cancer is for breast cancer right now. So part of what we will be doing as we expand this is expanding it to the other cancers.
Okay.
For the timing and the different cameras. You know, Dusty refers to the fact that she likes to use PET imaging for cardiac and she likes rubidium. Well, there is a specific protocol written for heart disease using rubidium for heart disease with PET cameras. Mm-hmm. But the numbers on that will be different than using a PET camera with ammonia or okay. FDG or a SPECT camera with thallium. Thallium can be used for breast imaging, by the way, for breast cancer imaging. It's been done. But the timing is different. You have to understand the timing. So the timing for ovarian cancer is something that will need to be looked at. But when FMT-VDM is fully implemented, when all of the numbers have been acquired, and this is going to take us 10, 15, 20 years to do. I mean, as I said, we have just opened a door between the old world of qualitative impression right. and the new world of quantitative measurement. Mm-hmm. When it's all put together, you will be able to have a complete body scan in a very short period of time that tells you exactly where your entire body lies on a health spectrum. Okay. Under those circumstances, it is very easy to understand how the ovarian cells that clearly had sloughed off, you know, fallen off in the process, had chance to grow into cancer, will be detected at an earlier stage. Treatment for that type of cancer when it's discovered will depend upon the numbers and the people. Now, frankly, if I were a woman, which I'm not, but let's pretend I'm a woman who's had a hysterectomy and an oophorectomy. The right. ovaries have been taken out. What was that? Total abdominal hysterectomy, bilateral self-inch oophorectomy. That was one of the first phrases we learned in medical school that we thought, oh, we're doctors.
That's for everybody.
THPSO. Is that if it were me, I would go, you know what? I'll go to the operating room for you to go in there and take that out. Just get that out. Yeah, it didn't come with the rest of it. And, you know, let's get it out. And then we'll follow it to see if I need to do anything else. And maybe I'll just improve how I'm living and the toxins I'm putting into my body, so I stand the best chance of maintaining a strong immune system and attacking anything else. Okay. Right. Because if I can find a lump on something, I have to agree on the surgeons with this. Cut it out. It doesn't belong there. I don't even want it left in my body if it's a cancer that's been successfully killed. Cut it out. You know, proton therapy, an area that you have an interest in, proton therapy is excision of a cancer without getting in there and taking it out, but it's killing the thing dead.
Right.
There is no good cancer to leave alive. A dead cancer is a good cancer. Okay.
I don't disagree with you. A dead cancer is a good cancer.
Yeah.
I guess, which is what I've spent all of my life doing, making dead cancers.
You know, cancers are like teenagers or residents. That's my analogy. They're like teenagers and residents. They eat a lot, they consume a lot, and they don't do anything of value for the rest of the body.
I don't, you know, I may agree on both points. I've had teenagers and worked with a lot of residents. So.
Right.
Well, Dr. Fleming, I thank you again. Like I said, I got to ask some questions that have kind of been hanging over me there about, you know, about the length of time that it takes to develop cancer, just based on things that somebody said somewhere and the environmental factors and all. And I think you've made such an important difference in helping me and everybody else to understand those things.
Thank you. That's very kind of you to say.
Well, and when that Big Pharma book gets written, we got to do this again.
That is number three. The FMTVDM book is done. The book on diets and what we do know and what we don't know.
That's a good one too.
I'm 2/3 of the way through that. Only a few more chapters to write, and I've been putting in 14-hour days. The hardest chapters are written. And so now I'm getting onto the more relaxing ones. And when we get off the air, I'll be going to the next chapter on that one. And then the Big Pharma, Big Food book follows that. And that is probably the longest one, because I think there's something like 12 or 13 chapters I've proposed for that. I've done a couple of the chapters on that. It's you know, when you, we'll need another program.
We will. That'll be a good one. I just watched a good documentary on Netflix called The Game Changers, and it's about plant-based proteins versus, I don't eat much meat anyway, some seafood every now and then. But that was a very interesting documentary. So for anybody out there that wants to watch that, it's called The Game Changers. I think it's on Netflix. It may be HBO or Amazon Prime or one of them, but I think it's Netflix. So that was a good one to watch. So
I appreciate it. Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Thank you, and we'll talk soon.
All right. Thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.